Welcome back. You're listening to Voices from the Frontlines here on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. On Monday, October 24th, civil rights legend Rosa Parks passed away. Most know her for her act of civil disobedience by not giving up her seat for a white man. And there's a lot about this woman that our history books don't tell us. Here to help us explore the legacy of this freedom fighter is Timothy Tyson, professor of Afro-American Studies at the University of Wisconsin. Welcome, Professor Tyson, to Voices from the Frontlines. Professor Tyson?
Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I was trying to think about how to proceed with this interview earlier in the day, and I think the first thing we should do is first, why don't you help us describe the incident that led to the status of Rosa Parks on December 1st, 1955, you know, the formation of the Montgomery Improvement Association, and actually the eventual victory. I think would be good just to even break down the historical record of that struggle for people.
Well, Rosa Parks was part of a movement in Montgomery that had been going on for, well, a long time, but she had been active for about 13 or 14 years at that point. She had, she was secretary to E.D. Nixon, the most politically central activist in black Montgomery. He was the head of the NAACP and the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. Mm-hmm. She was secretary to both of those organizations. She was a seasoned activist. She had been trained at Highlander Folk School, which is one of the few places in the Jim Crow South where black and white people got together to talk about how to transform their communities. So she was about as politically active as anybody in the African-American community in Montgomery. She had had trouble on the buses. She didn't like to ride the bus. She had had trouble with the driver, James Blake, in an incident some years earlier. And he liked for black people to get on the back of the bus and not the front. Mm-hmm. He had made her get off, and she wouldn't get back on. She had trouble. There was bad blood between them. She didn't plan to do this. On December 1st, 1955, she had gotten onto the bus, and the bus had filled up, and he had ordered her to move from her seat, and she wouldn't. So he had her arrested. She was put in jail. As soon as E.D. Nixon heard that Ms. Parks was in jail, he and everybody else who was clued in to what was going on in that circle of activists knew that there would be a bus boycott. They did not ask her, you know, Mrs. Parks, would you go down there and get arrested on the bus? But they had had two other cases in recent times where they had almost run a bus boycott and backed off at the last minute because a black woman had been abused and arrested on the buses. And then a year earlier, the Women's Political Council, which was very instrumental in the bus boycott as it unfolded, had written a letter to the mayor threatening explicitly a bus boycott a year earlier. So this was neither spontaneous. She was not a tired old woman whose feet hurt and couldn't see her way clear to moving to the back of the bus, as is often portrayed. Nor was this planned exactly. But it was clear that this was a central issue, especially among black women in Montgomery, that they weren't going to put up with this anymore, and that there was a widespread sense among politically active black residents of Montgomery that something would be done. So it didn't come out of nowhere.
Professor Tyson, why do you think that in our history books now, I mean, I went to school in the 80s, and, you know, I remember the plain story was, she was just tired and didn't want to give up her seat and, you know, generally had been tired of Jim Crow in general, but you know, not at all has there any real explanation of who these people are and who are the real actors, and that the strike even lasted a whole year. It was a pretty comprehensive strike that involved, you know, almost every sector of black life inside Montgomery. Yet, you know, in our books, it's almost like somebody, you know, she didn't want to give up her seat. It took some struggle, and, you know, Jim Crow was broken. And in fact, we know that was just, you know, after 1956, I mean, it took almost another, you know, maybe 8 to 10 years, where you saw some real mass, changes in, you know, federal government and the federal government legislation around the question around equal rights?
Well, I think that's a really a very good question. I think it's because somehow we want in sort of American pop culture, we want individual heroism plus magic, and we want it all to resolve in 22 minutes plus commercials, you know. So we like this Rosa Parks story. We also like our people innocent, mm-hmm. not political. Mm-hmm. People really don't want to hear about Rosa Parks, the activist. They really want those tired feet. They try to make her old, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's, you're getting the sense that she's an old woman with tired feet. But you can find this stuff in textbooks. But I think we're hesitant to honor the day-to-day labors that make our communities fit places to live. The women especially who do these thankless labors of being on all these committees and doing the kind of day-to-day activist community-oriented labor that make our schools and our communities decent places to be. We're reluctant to honor them. Instead, we sort of want something heroic and a little bit magical. And I think it has a lot to do with our post-civil rights racial narrative, too. You know, we like our Rosa Parks to be demure and innocent, not political, just tired. It sort of suits us. And we also, you know, we want a nonviolent thing. We want something that doesn't take, we get the sense that it's really a moral witness, and that because she was so good and so pure and because she stood up for her conscience, that somehow this made the walls come a tumbling down. Instead, of course, we know that social change comes through an ongoing struggle of day-to-day organizing and mobilizing communities to act in their own self-interest. You know, and it's not about saints and crusades. There's not a lot of violins in the background.
Well, it's funny you're saying that because...
But that's what we want.
Right.
Now, especially from Rosa Parks.
Yeah. Oh, it's funny you say that because, you know, me and Tammy are both organizers with the Bus Riders Union here in Los Angeles. And, you know, we always constantly get calls from the press. And they always say, well, we want to talk to a bus rider. And we say, well, great. You know, you can talk to Barbara Lott Holland, who's the co-chair of the Bus Riders Union. You can talk to Rosalio Mendiola, who's, who is also... a hotel worker, but he's also been a leader of the Bus Riders Union for the last 10 years. And they're like, well, I don't want somebody who's not necessarily in the organization, as if, you know, if they have any form of political consciousness, they no longer can represent the actual class, you know?
Right. So if you don't have political consciousness and you're not involved in an organized movement, somehow that is better and it makes your motives less suspect.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you're dedicated to your community, and to fairness and decency, and you do that on a day-to-day basis, that's just not as, that's somehow suspect. We think of that person must be, you know, we think of that person as a crackpot or somebody who's very self-interested, you know. We want our little heroes to be innocuous and not part of a social movement, which is of course a guarantee that we'll never get one,
mm-hmm.
you know. It frustrates me, and it frustrated Mrs. Parks, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that you talk about this amnesia on one side on most mainstream people, but, you know, it's funny, we got an email this weekend from The Reaction about this topic and having you on the show, and you know, it said, Rosa Parks was no hero as far as I'm concerned. She was a zealous integrationist who felt she was nobody unless she was kissing white people's behinds, which is, to me, it's completely... You know, one, it's a very ignorant statement because I want you to now go into some real discussions about Rosa Parks post, you know, the Montgomery bus boycott, her relationship to people like black nationalists like Robert Williams and Malcolm X, and even her positions on nonviolence. Can you talk to us and give us some light on who Rosa Parks really was beyond what, you know, at least mainstream and even on sometimes the narrative of even... I would say people on the left who don't want to really necessarily recognize her role as a real freedom fighter.
Well, you know, that's just so ignorant. I can't even know where to start. You know, the idea of Mrs. Parks as some kind of white man's Negro is just so ridiculous that it's hard to even. But and also, I don't want to break it up into Montgomery and then what comes after so much, because it's important to recognize Mrs. Parks got her politics especially from her grandfather. They were close. She was his sort of, he was her political teacher. And he was in the Marcus Garvey movement, right? He was at UNIA in Alabama. And so she grew up schooled by a Garveyite. Her first political activity is with her husband, Raymond, when they were a young married couple in the early 1930s. They were active in the movement to free the Scottsboro defendants, which was, you know, an international case involving the left and black labor. You know, it was radical politics writ large. That was her background. Then during World War II, when she becomes a secretary for the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, which that was the days of the March on Washington movement, you know, all-black political mass action led by A. Philip Randolph. She was in the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. You're working with them. And with the NAACP, there's a rape case in 1944 in Abbeville, Alabama, and a woman named Reese Taylor was gang-raped by a carload of white men at gunpoint, and the NAACP sent an investigator up to look at the case in Abbeville, and the investigator's name was Rosa Parks. And Rosa Parks became the organizer for the Committee to Defend Mrs. Reese Taylor, which was a national, you know, committee with involved with a lot of the left and you know, part of mass action. This is in the 40s. And if you look at the people in the Committee to Defend Miss Reese Taylor, this women's activism against sexual assault, if you look down it, it's practically the Montgomery Improvement Association. It really began, you know, 10 years earlier around sexual assault against black women. So, you know, and she, this is just an ongoing thing. Later, she has to leave Montgomery in 1957. It's not safe for her to be there. She and her husband have a hard time there with death threats and whatnot. And so they move to Detroit. She becomes a black nationalist, I should say, again, you know, really, because she was raised that way. And she's a great admirer of Malcolm X. I met Mrs. Parks at the funeral of Robert F. Williams, the black militant leader from North Carolina who had fought the Klan with machine guns in North Carolina in the late 1950s and had gone to Cuba and China and been kind of an international icon of the black power movement. She delivered his eulogy in Monroe, North Carolina in 1996, which was where I met her. So the divide between the sort of conventional civil rights movement, as we sort of falsely think of it, and the black power movement is really artificial. And she's, you know, spends her life standing up for black liberation in a variety of different ways. And to think of her, to dismiss her as some kind of moderate or integrationist or accommodationist or somebody who was in love with white people is just ignorant.
Can you talk about her work in Detroit? I mean, was she at all associated with the League of Revolutionary Black Workers? And later, we understand she worked for Representative Conyers, who many of us know has been trying to pass H.R. 40 around reparations for black folks inside the United States.
Well, yes, she did work in Representative Conyers' office and was, you know, active locally and knew the folks in the – I'm not sure about activism around the – League of Revolutionary Workers. I know that she knows those people and that they know her, but I'm not familiar with that local history. But you know, she continues to be. She understood her symbolic political role. You know who she was as Rosa Parks, and she continued to use that and to confer that dignity and that legitimacy on. Revolutionary struggles in Detroit and elsewhere. And, you know, she didn't just accidentally happen to be at Robert F. Williams' funeral either. You know, that was part of that community.
Well, you know, it's interesting that we have this conversation around the role of black women inside organizations. You know, I know a couple of years ago there was a very important book around, you know, the women who basically made the Montgomery bus boycott, given that in many ways in our own narratives, right, we know of the very young Reverend Martha Luther King who obviously played a very important and vital role in that campaign. And I think one of the things that's happening is, like you were saying earlier, is this conversation around organization and people being involved and people being in struggle has been completely almost lost. Because not only is the narratives are taught, but in many ways we're also taught that the only way you can make change is, you know, it's either a one person or one great leader who sort of assumes the leadership of being able to move something forward, which, I mean, to a certain degree, I also believe in that. But obviously, you need the thousands and thousands of people to really make something happen.
Yes, speech is not what toppled Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've always got somebody who can speak. My goodness. You know, Martin Luther King was a great preacher. But really, without the marching feet, the talking heads don't get anywhere. You know, and that's just the most... I think of Dr. King, and Dr. King had an important role, but he was only 26 years old in Montgomery when that emerges. He really doesn't know that... He's not a seasoned veteran like Mrs. Parks or E.D. Nixon. And though he's an important symbolic leader, I think of him as a kind of gospel singer. You know, he went from place to place, making a joyful noise unto the Lord, lifting up everybody's spirits, you know, imbuing the struggle with a kind of passion and dignity that he carried with him that was his inheritance. But that's an important role. But, you know, it takes the hundreds and hundreds of people in Montgomery who ran off the leaflets and distributed, you know, flyers and organized the meetings and the carpool and all of those things that had to happen for the Montgomery bus boycott to happen. That really wasn't about oratory. You know, it was about people being active in their communities in a less dramatic way, but at the same time, it's a doable thing. You know, real ordinary people did this. You know, you don't have to be, you know, Martin Luther King was a genius, but you don't have to be a genius to be an important citizen and to join together with other people and make your community a better place.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Given that you've also been in the academic world, how have a lot of young people been addressing this question? Because in many ways, I guess I'm asking that question sort of out of an egotistical realm, because for me, it wasn't until I came to the Bus Riders Union that I really find what my role in the world and what my role in history would be. But, you know, in school, I learned and read a lot of the books, and there was a, sort of a de-emphasis on what a movement is, because so much in the academic world right now is to sort of break down and deconstruct everything from, you know, any sort of master narrative is broken down in a way that it no longer has any meaning, where almost human capacity can't change anything because history seems to feel unmovable. How have you seen in your realm of being in the academics in that sense, seen any change in that point?
Well, as for deconstruction, Lyndon Johnson once said, any jackass can kick a barn down. It takes a pretty good carpenter to build one. You know, problem is we don't have too many carpenters in the academy. We don't have, and I mean that almost literally, we don't really have people in the academy, or we don't have enough of them, who have the background in organizing and in community struggles to really know how that works. So you can theorize about things, and theory, you know, analyzing things is important. You know, the people who Mrs. Parks and E.D. Nixon analyzed mm-hmm. their own experience, you know, mm-hmm. and acted on it. So they were intellectuals in that sense, too. Just like Dr. King was, not in some kind of published formal way necessarily, but in a grassroots kind of way. You know, you got to think about how things went and how are we going to respond to that. So we don't have that so much in the academy, and we also have a tendency to write in ways that people are not interested in reading.
Well, thank you, Professor.
That's regrettable.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Well, thank you, Professor Tyson. This is Manuel Criollo, and with Tammy Banglu, we're saying goodbye to next week. We'd like to thank our guest today, Baghdad Jasmine, Assemblywoman Karen Bass, and Timothy Tyson. Today we had music from Arrested Development, Gil Scott Heron, John Coltrane, and John Cherry, and Cuba Mar. You can listen to our previous shows on www.thestrategycenter.org, and we have a new comment line, voices@thestrategycenter.org. We'd like to thank our producer, Alan Minsky, our assistant producer, Lisa Adler, our engineer, Maggie LaPeak, and we'll see you next week from Voices from the Frontlines Radio. Up next is Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman.
You've been listening to the 4 o'clock report, Voices from the Frontline edition.